Today's Teisho will be on Case 61 in the Book of Serenity. Case 61 is entitled John Fong's One. Introduction. A roundabout explanation is easy to understand. It imparts with one hand. A direct explanation is hard to understand. It opens up in all dimensions. I urge you not to use clear speech, for if speech is clear, getting out is all the more difficult. If you don't believe, let's try to bring this up. Case. A monk asked John Fong, "The blessed ones in the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of Nirvana. Where is that road?" John Fong drew a line in the air with his staff and said, "It is here." The monk asked Yunmen the same question. Yunmen said, "The fan leaps to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit once with the stick and it rains buckets. Do you understand? Do you understand?" Verse. Starting in, it turns out, he uses medicine for a dead horse. The reviving incense is about to cause you peril. If all your life you squeeze out threats through all your body, only then, if all your life you squeeze out sweat through all your body, only then will you believe he didn't spare his eyebrows. This is the first day of our August 2008 Sesshin, and it's what a beautiful morning. Cool. This morning was just beautifully refreshing, and I don't know if you noticed when we were walking out of the bunkhouse, the stars were overhead, and you know, cloudless sky, stars, clear, cool weather, and this morning, beautiful, beautiful. I mean, this is so unusual, right, for August in New Jersey. Quite what a wonderful way to start the Sesshin. However, you know, it's going to get a little hotter later in the week, and that's going to be good too. Because this is a different kind of experience, you know. Different Zen is a different way to live. Different way to live. And modern people have a hard time, I think, grasping what it's all about. Maybe that's because we've spent so much of our time in classrooms taking notes and watching television, and actually staring at a computer screen. Those are all sort of like forms of collective self-hypnosis, maybe. And so it might be a little hard to understand what we're doing at first, but everybody here has a deep intuitive understanding, or you wouldn't be here. But all the same, I just wanted to say a few things about it. You know, I was reading in the newspaper the other day on my computer screen, about a man whose name escapes me right now. But he was the he is a Mormon, and he was a young filmmaker maybe 10 years ago. And he decided that Mormon people, and there's about 15 million Mormons in the United States, didn't really have a cinema, didn't really have a movie industry. And he wanted to make movies for Mormon people. He wanted to make movies that reflected sort of the dilemmas of Mormon life and the truth, tell the story of Mormon life. And he produced a movie and directed it, and I think he probably wrote most of the script. And I'm afraid I don't have the title, but it was quite successful. It really was. It was it was an indie picture, you know, something that was not made with funding from one of the big studios. And but it was very well received, especially in Utah, where most Mormons live. Also, they tend to live in Arizona and Idaho. So he started to create a Mormon film industry. And he helped other young Mormons get into the film business. And he became, we could say, like a champion or a standard bearer of Mormon culture in the United States. And he's quite an intelligent person. And just recently, he, after putting in all this work for 10 years, made some kind of a public statement that he could no longer believe in his religion, and that he was actually making a movie about losing his religion. And as you could well expect, a lot of people were disappointed, and a lot of people were hurt, and probably not too many people were angry, but it must have been hurtful for many people who no doubt love Mormonism and are proud of their ancestors, to have this person walk away like this, especially in such a public way. But he went through a real crisis, And he struggled. Apparently his wife is not a Mormon, but she said he really struggled with his desire to believe and his failure to believe. And at the end of it, he just couldn't believe anymore. And I mean, it's easy if you're not in it, to see in a way how unbelievable some of these beliefs really are. So, for example, the Mormons teach things that, if you're not a Mormon, seem obviously untrue. So for example, they teach that the Indians, many of the people in, not in India, but in the United States, many of the Native Americans, are actually Jews who came here on boats and settled and started a civilization after the fall of Jerusalem at the time of the Babylonian captivity. And basically they say that when Jesus appeared in the Holy Land, he also appeared in the New World and made revelations here. And these teachings were revealed to a prophet whose name was Joseph Smith. And he was shown by an angel tablets of gold, and he was told to copy down with a, he had a special filter he would put over the tablets, because they were supposed to be written in Hebrew. And the filter was magic, and it would translate it into English, and he would write it down. And that became the Book of Mormon. Now, you know, people have done genetic testing of the Native Americans, and actually they come from Asia. They're very closely related, believe it or not, to Mongolians and Tibetans, and Koreans. I had a friend of mine who was Korean who went to Arizona once, and he was out on the reservation. And everybody there thought he was a Navajo. You know, they kept, what's happening, you know? And he fit right in, you know. These beliefs seem ridiculous if you're not inside of them. But when you're inside of them, they're very compelling and very reassuring, and they're a source of a great sustenance. And so it was very difficult for this person to give these beliefs up. After all, those were the beliefs of his parents, or at least some of the people in his family. For many Mormons, they've been Mormons for many generations. Actually, I think in this case, this filmmaker had become a Mormon as a little boy, but I believe some people in his family were Mormons. He went through some kind of a struggle, and it's like his whole reality sort of like collapsed. You know, it's like you want so much to believe in something. It's like a beautiful story. And it's, you know, so hard sometimes to live without it. But then it just disappears all around you, and you might feel exposed and directionless, you know. I think it takes great courage for people to go through this process. Interestingly, I was reading recently also, I sometimes read the magazine Psychology Today. And Psychology Today also had an article about people of faith who lose their faith. And they were primarily interested in Christian ministers and also priests. And the psychology of losing your faith, your religion. And one person they interviewed was a Lutheran minister. And he had worked for 20 years to build his congregation. And he had, you know, really like great diligence, you know. And he studied the scriptures. And he was composing... I guess he was writing a song about Jesus as a lamb. Lamb is a symbol of Jesus' gentleness. But he couldn't continue to write the song, you know. It was like all this time, in the back of his mind, something was happening. And at a certain moment, it all just crystallized. And then he was terrified because he couldn't believe any of this anymore, you know. Now, you know, if you look at all, my opinion is actually, if you look at any religion, many of the beliefs are actually illogical or untenable. You know, Mormonism is so close to us that it seems absurd. Of course, we think the Jews didn't settle in the New World. That's just ridiculous, right? But if this at all was 2,000 years ago, and you know the American Indians were long gone, and we didn't know the history that well, it all might seem much more possible, you know. Also, if you grow up in a belief system that has a kind of naturalness, right? It just seems, of course, this is the case, you know. Every once in a while, people, when they're 13 or 14, will get into arguments, and you start thinking, well, wait, that's not possible, right? You know, somebody went out and lived for 40 days and 40 nights without any food, that's not possible. I can remember having an argument with my mother when I was about 12, and my mother told me she didn't believe a minister ever had been in a car accident. She was sure that couldn't possibly happen. And I said, but mother, you know, it must happen that a minister could get in a car accident. And finally she said, all right, well, maybe, but only if he didn't pray that morning. So, you know, there's a kind of unreality to all this, right? But basically, if you grow up in these systems, they seem totally natural. And this poor man had given his whole life to this belief system. And there were things he encountered in the system that he began to sort of nag at him. You know, beliefs that he had to say, well, that can't be. And then he sort of pushed that away. And then a little bit it came back and he pushed it. And he was so afraid to even think, okay, well, you know, maybe the world wasn't created. Okay. If I say the world wasn't created in 7 days, if I don't believe that, what will I believe? Where will the doubt stop? See, it's like if I let any doubt in my life, where will the doubt stop? It will eat up everything. So I can't question that the world was created in 7 days. I can't allow myself to question that. And so it's like, you know, you don't want to open the door because the doubt might eat you up, eat everything up. And this minister went quietly to friends of his, you know, and said, listen, I suddenly find myself unable to believe any of this. And his friends, he actually went to a psychiatrist who was also a Lutheran. And the psychiatrist sort of yelled at him, you know, said, buck up, you know, get back on your horse, you know. And he could find people who were sympathetic, but nobody wanted to join him in his experience of doubt, you know. And he eventually left his job, which is very interesting, you know, and stopped being a minister. There were other stories. One person went, changed denominations from, like, he became a Unitarian with a more broad-minded approach. This article had a number of people who were like that. And indeed, my mother had asked to be buried and have a Lutheran service. And she was buried in Williamsburg, Virginia. My sister investigated the congregation there, and there had been a very distinguished minister at that congregation, and he had resigned and walked away from his life, and somebody else had taken over and was rebuilding. But that person too must have had like a crisis of faith, you know. It doesn't have to be like religious doubt. Sometimes we have other kinds of doubts. It's like, we might be pursuing something in our lives, and then one day it's like there's a little thread hanging out, you know? Have you ever had this experience where you have a piece of cloth, you have like a sweater or a shirt, and you notice there's a thread hanging out. You pull the thread, but it doesn't stop, you know? It just starts unraveling. That's shocking, isn't it? At least if you need to wear that item of clothing, you know. I was in a meeting once for that. I was so bored, I started picking at my suit coat. I don't wear suit coats anymore, but at one time I started pulling this thread and it started to unweave the fabric, you know. So I had like a little ball that I tried to discreetly stick into my sleeve, you know. But it's slightly weird, you know. It's like, you don't want to do that to your life, right? But sometimes something will happen where you just have this experience, you know, where you begin to, it's like, if I pull this thread, you know, everything is going to come out. I was in graduate school, I was sitting in a class with a very distinguished teacher whose name was Don Bialystoski, and his period was Romantic literature, so this was like Wordsworth and Shelley. If you know anything about English literature, these are highly regarded English poets. And there's a poem called Mont Blanc. And Mont Blanc is this long poem by this man Shelley, and it's a meditation on this mountain. And it is utterly incomprehensible, in my opinion. And we were sitting there discussing it for like an hour and a half. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. You know, it was like the thread in my sleeve. I began to think, you know, this is crazy. You know, this is like insane to be discussing this poem. Nobody knows what it means. Shelley doesn't know it, didn't know what it meant, you know. And we're actually spending the whole afternoon discussing this poem. Meanwhile, you know, all the world has all kinds of problems, you know. And I immediately thought, well, that's ridiculous, you know. This is very important. But little by little, it was like I could never take, you know, I could never do that again. Actually, I never do that. I don't do that kind of work as an English teacher, because it just seems to me, I couldn't believe in it anymore. I lost my religion of poetry, you know. Not that I don't like poetry, but I lost that belief, you know. And when we tend to believe that losing your beliefs, losing your religion, losing your faith in a political system or a cultural arrangement or whatever, is the worst thing that can happen to you. You know, that, I mean, people who are devout are terrified by those moments when they suddenly think, this couldn't be true. Now, this is not true. And that's like this thread coming out of your sleeve, and you start sticking that ball back in the sleeve to hide it. Because the person you don't want to see it is yourself. So, you know, we all do this, you know. There's a kind of terror, a dizziness, right? When things we have held on to, beliefs we have held on to, start to fall apart on us, you know. And we might feel that we're being, that we're suddenly hanging in space with no place to grasp, no place to set our feet, no direction. And it can be terrifying. You know, I thought these stories of people losing their faith, losing their beliefs, were very moving. Have been through that myself, you know. People think that if they lose their faith, or they lose their beliefs, or they lose their culture, or whatever, it's the end. You know, they'll just be a cast adrift, and so on and so on. And people literally, you know, get down on their knees and beg God or the universe to restore their ability to believe in things. I mean, it's a truly terrifying experience for some people. But actually, I think losing your beliefs is really a wonderful thing, having gone through that myself. And I think it's quite possible to live without beliefs of any kind. You can say, well, you believe in Buddhism, but, you know, actually I believe in having no beliefs. And I think that's Buddhism. So maybe I do have beliefs, but they're kind of strange beliefs, right? It's possible to live without beliefs. And far from this being a horrible experience of rootlessness and no direction and help, it's very liberating, in my opinion. Beliefs are actually not real. No matter which ones you want to point to, they're not actually real. And if you step outside of, I think, any belief system and you look at it, you'll see all kinds of things that are ridiculous. I was reading in the paper about this economist, and he's a sort of like an unusual economist, because for the last 6 years he's been saying the American economy is going to collapse, basically. He said the housing market is going to collapse. He said banks are going to fail. He said all these things. He said these like 6 years ago, and he would go to conferences where there were other economists speaking, and he'd give these talks, and he's famous. They would call him Mr. Doom and Gloom, right? And he'd come in and say, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And people would just go, oh, you're always, you know, you're always a naysayer, you know, you're always the skeptic, blah, blah, blah. And of course, everything that the article in the paper was saying, remarkably, everything he said would happen has happened. Right? He was somebody who woke up one morning and just couldn't believe, right? He could have just said, oh my gosh, I can't tell anybody. I can't tell my friends that I'm not a believer anymore in the religion of American economics, right? But he instead he sort of came out of the closet, and he said it like it was, and what do you know? He turns out to be right. So it's frightening though, you know, when you look around and everybody else is going to church or to temple or something, and you're not, or everybody else believes in such and such, and you don't, you know, that's it's scary. But it's possible to live without beliefs, and this is really what Zen is all about, right? I mean, when you come to Sesshin, you're going to it's possible to experience life in what I think is a much richer and deeper way, because there's a kind of reality which is beyond belief. It doesn't depend upon that part of your mind which says yes or no, I believe or I don't believe. It's hard to describe, but little by little at Sesshin we begin to experience it. You know, so you know we come to Sesshin with maybe an agenda, you know. Maybe we are here to have enlightenment experience. You know, maybe we believe in enlightenment. You know, and so we're coming here. We think, okay, maybe there is such a thing as enlightenment. You know, I'm going to come to Sesshin. I'm going to do my practice, and I may have enlightenment. Or you might be coming to Sesshin because things haven't been going well in your life, and you want to maybe atone for something you've done wrong, or maybe you're coming to Sesshin because you're having a lot of problems with stress and you want release from your stress. There's all these reasons for coming to Sesshin, and you may have a lot of ideas too, you know. You might have been reading books on Zen. You might have quite a big sheet of questions about Zen. But you know, by tomorrow, those questions won't make any difference at all, you know. It's like I was reading. There's a very famous Russian philosopher whose name was Bakhtin, and Bakhtin wrote these books during the Stalin administration, when Stalin was running Russia, and he couldn't get any of them published because they weren't. They questioned the religion of the Soviet Union, and so Bakhtin had all of these manuscripts sitting in his office, where he would work, and at one point when the Germans invaded Russia, there was no more paper, and so Bakhtin he could get tobacco, but he couldn't get paper. You know, so he used to take his pages of his book and cut them up and roll them into cigarettes and smoke them. And you know, it was more important for him to have a cigarette than it was for those ideas to survive. In that moment, see, it was more important to smoke them, you know, than to. So you know, that's you could say, oh, poor man, he had an addiction. But actually, there's a kind of deep truth to that, right? I mean, ideas aren't real. You know, ideas aren't real. And every once in a while, we realize, you know, these are just ideas. The reality of things is so much bigger than our ideas. And these little systems we create are just fantasies, right? They're fantasies. My sister-in-law had a problem with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And she developed it when she was about 12 or 13 years old. And by the time she was an adult, she hadn't learned to deal with it, but she had learned to conceal it. So one day I was sitting in a room and I watched her come through the room, and she didn't think anybody was watching her. She came through the door, she went back out, she came through the door a second time. And I saw her do that again on another occasion. And we're pretty good friends, and her name is Chris. And I said, "Chris, you know, I love you. I wonder, why do you do that?" And we talked about it, and she said, "You know, when I was about 12, I was very worried that my mother and father were going to split up. And what I decided to do was that if I didn't go through the door twice, something terrible would happen to my family." This is like OCD. This is sort of like a very classic OCD behavior. So she makes sure the universe and her family and everybody are okay by going through the door, going back out, and going through the door twice. Always goes through the door twice. You're very good at hiding it. You'd never notice, right? This is very human, right? Anyway, it's actually better not to go through the door twice. It's actually better. It's actually liberating to just walk through the door. But we create these mental habits that are designed to protect us, but we kind of become prisoners. And then when everything seems to be disappearing, it can be a little frightening, but believe me, every day you'll feel better. Today you come to Sesshin with maybe agendas, ideas, questions. But tomorrow or the next day, all you want to do is survive. You know, all you want to do is just be in the moment. Yeah? And you might think, well, that's just becoming an idiot. But, oh, that is so wrong. That is so wrong. I think if you're so afraid that you go through a door twice, that's making you into an idiot. That's making you less intelligent about how you deal with the world. See? A person who's so afraid they have to go through the door twice every time they go through the door and can't control themselves is not more intelligent, is less intelligent. People who dare not believe the world was created in, say, 13.7, actually the world wasn't created, it's still creating. 13.7 billion years ago, what we call this universe started, probably, and it's still being created by itself, I think. You know, but I could be wrong, that's just a belief. But the point is, it doesn't make me more intelligent to cling to my beliefs. It makes me, in my opinion, less intelligent. So I think, you know, when we begin to get too tired to have beliefs, or we keep bringing them, you know, Zen practice involves watching the breath, and you keep coming back to the moment, and back to the moment, and back to the moment. And you have all these fears, and all these dreams, and all this, and all that. But sooner or later, you know, it all just falls apart. And when it falls apart, when you lose, whatever your religion happens to be, you know, when you lose your religion on, say, day two or day three of this session, you're going to feel like a door has opened in yourself. Now, I'm not going to tell you won't have pain in your legs, but you're going to feel so much better, very likely. And you're going to feel, you know, one day you're going to walk into the meal, and you're going to sit down, and you're going to have rice in your bowl, and you're not going to think, oh no, rice again. Or you're just going to stare at the bowl and the rice in the bowl, and you're going to eat that rice, and it's going to be so delicious. I mean, when I was a little boy, going to like church, we would have a communion, and we would drink little thing of wine, and little thing of eat a little piece of bread. And you know, I did that a number of times, and it never had any effect on me. But I've been at Sashin, and you know, I've been hear the wind, and it's just so beautiful. Or just looking at light on the floor with an empty mind, with an open mind. It's just, that's like real sacrament. That's like really sacred, you know, really, not pretend, we're not pretending. It really is, you know, in my opinion. I think we're imprisoned by our beliefs, by, you know, and I don't just mean religious beliefs, I mean all kinds of beliefs, personal beliefs, cultural beliefs. And we think, you know, if I lose these, I've got nothing. But, you know, people make themselves so ill and so unhappy, and not just as individuals, but as civilizations, you know, really as like whole cultures are unhappy. It's amazing. And in fact, some people don't really think they have a right to be happy, you know, actually. So, you know, please lose your beliefs. Please just be in this moment over and over and over again. It's not easy, you know. Maybe it's very hard to just be in the moment. You just sit on the cushion, straighten your back, use your dantian, squeeze the breath out. The breath goes out, 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 out. And for just a moment, maybe your mind is just here now, you know. And then, you know, the fantasy machine starts up again, you know, and there's the dialogue, and there's the memory, and all of this stuff. And you just latch onto your breath and go out with your breath, and again, for just a second, you're just in the moment. And then, you know, the fantasy machine starts up again. But it's interesting, you would think how easy it must be to just sit on the cushion and watch your breath, but, you know, as soon as people start sitting on the cushion and watching the breath, they just lose, it's just like they start secreting fantasies. It's just astounding. Right? I mean, humans are very strange creatures. Not at all what philosophers tell us we're like. You know, humans are like a dream, you know, fantasy machine. You sit on the cushion and you start secreting fantasies. A dense fantasy. So it's actually quite difficult to be in the moment. And so we have, fortunately, we have like tools we can use. There's using the whole body as an instrument of liberation. So the body is a wonderful opportunity for this, a wonderful helper, I should say. You know, if you arrange the body in the incorrect way, it can't be as helpful to you as if you arrange the body in the correct way. So having balanced on the cushion, straight back, breathing through the hara, the dantian, watching the breath go out, and of course, you know, your mind is going to be all over the place, but you just have to sort of pull yourself back to your breath and follow the breath out. And you might be able to do that only once in every 10 minutes, but if you can just do it once, it's helping you enormously. And if you can just be in the moment for just a couple of minutes, you know, you're going to feel better. I say this to beginners, and it's the truth. You know, you're going to feel better. The amazing thing, I mean, actually, you know, the Buddha didn't really talk about, where do we come from? Where are we going? How old is the universe? This kind of stuff. He actually refused to. They actually said, "Do we have a soul?" He said, "I'm not going to comment on that." He didn't say yes. He didn't say no. He said, "I said totally wrong. I refuse to even talk about that." And he said, "You know, your real problem is that you are in agony right now. This is like a person with a poison arrow in his ankle, and instead of taking the arrow, he's arguing about, what is pain anyway? Or, trying to develop a theory, right? And it's like, no, you're in agony right now, pull the arrow out, you know. Another example is like, we're like in a burning house, right? And we don't believe, is it really burning? What are flames, you know? He says, please, don't bother, who built this house anyway, you know? It's like, just get out of the damn house, right? And the test is, if you don't feel any better, then you're in the wrong place. But if you just try it, if you just try to make, we're here for 5 very short days, very precious days. If you bring your mind back to the moment, over and over again, you're going to have maybe just this instance where you're in the moment, and it's so liberating. It's so liberating. And all of our pain and suffering is produced by our... Now, if your legs hurt, you aren't responsible for the lactic acid in your muscles. That's the truth. You didn't do that. But, how you deal with that pain is really something you can control. And you can't fantasize your pain away, and you can't dream it away, and you can't philosophize it away. And indeed, if your legs are really hurting you, you can pray to high heaven and it won't help. At least it hasn't helped me. You know. What I would suggest you do is be in the moment. So, when my legs are hurting me, and I have pain too, you focus on your breath, you squeeze with the dantian, the breath goes out. And at the end of their breath, there's like this unshakable calm, this emptiness, this shunyata, mushin. And in that emptiness is real liberation. It's like real freedom. And it's real. It's real. We don't know what it is. I don't have a particular theory about it, but I just know when I get there, I'm liberated. And my view is that there's nothing that this can't deal with. But, if you're unhappy, if you're frightened or fretful, I don't have any illusions about this. You're doing it to yourself. And so you have to, have self-discipline. And not be caught in a fantasy, a labyrinth of dreams. A labyrinth is like a maze, right? A maze. Humans live like in a maze of dreams. And we go around this corner and we're terrified. We go around this corner and we're depressed. We go around this corner and we hate ourselves. So on and so on. What a horrible way to live. So please, you don't have to, there's a door out of that maze, and it's your breath, and you can leave the maze anytime you want. It's going to take a little work, but you can do it. So please do it. Please, you feel better? Whatever your religion is, please just lose your religion. It's really not necessary. A monk asked John Fung, "The blessed ones of the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of Nirvana. Where is that road?" John Fung drew a line in the air with his staff. He said, "Right here. Right here. There's a door out of the maze right here." Okay, then the monk isn't happy with that. He goes to another master, he goes to Yunmen. He's asked the same question. Yunmen says, "The fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit once with a stick and it rains buckets." Maybe the better answer is the second one, because it's bullshit, right? The guy told the truth. First guy told the truth, right? He said, "Look, all of this is crap. These belief systems are not real. Just be in the moment, please." And the guy goes, oh, that can't be possible. I'm free? Impossible. So he goes to the next guy, and the guy goes, oh, no, no. Don't you see, you know, the king is in heaven, the king of heaven, you know, throw the fan up there and it hits him on the nose, and, you know, it's like a little story you would tell a little kid, right? I mean, another piece of Zen literature says, you know, all these stories, beliefs are like shiny paper you show to a kid to stop him from crying, right? Say, oh, do you want some gold? You know, and the kid looks at the paper and thinks, oh, this is gold, right? You know, it's just a piece of paper. You know, but really, you know, that doesn't really work. Because you know, sooner or later you're going to grow up and you're going to go, oh, this is just a piece of paper, it's not gold. So really, ideas just don't work. You know, if you reach a point in your life where you can't believe in anything anymore, please, you should give yourself a good pat on the head. You're becoming a different kind of person. But if it's not a calamity, it's the most wonderful thing in the world. Our method in Zen is to investigate the world with an open mind. So what we do is we sit down on the cushion and we enter Mushin. When the fantasy factory stops and we're just in the moment, we can begin to examine how the world really is. And that's the whole method of Zen. You've got to get to that place where you can be in the moment, and it's very liberating. And then, what are all those koans about? Experiencing the world when you're free from belief, when you're free from fantasy. What's it really like? We have seen so little of the world as it actually is. So this is, the second story is bullshit. The first story is true. And maybe the editor says, well, you know, being too direct, sometimes people just don't listen to you. Maybe you need to tell them a little fairy story, you know. Okay, that's fine. Whatever will get you to sit on the cushion today and practice diligently, I'd be happy to say. But please do it. And you won't be sorry. You'll be happy. Your sadness will go away. And you'll be healthier. And you'll suddenly realize that everything around you is profoundly alive, and that the way we normally live is profoundly deadening. So it sounds good, doesn't it? And with my whole heart, so far as I know, that's the truth. That's how I live every day of my life. And I feel so alive, you know. And so please, give it a try and do your best.